From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in Alternative Inviting, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Martha McGarry, and I make Nice Games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make Nice Games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make Nice Games.
For this week's episode, our topics are pitching to consoles and turn-based RPG. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start. One.
Dalmatians?
Yes. Dalmatians.
And I get all of them.
Yeah, okay. That checks out. Yeah.
So last week was our 100th episode.
Yes.
Although, as you probably learned then, it was only minutes ago for us. And it's funny, we just finished recording it and we're like, oh, there's a bunch of things we forgot to talk about.
Yeah.
Like the air conditioner and the fact that we used to have three topics and now only have two topics.
Yeah.
Episode.
And you know, maybe we'll pepper in those stories a bit. Or do you just want to talk a little bit about that little sequel to the episode?
Okay. I guess like you used to have three topics per episode, but then the episode started getting really long.
Yeah.
So Martha convinced us to do two topics and I was heavily against it, but now I'm like, yeah, we're still talking a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Plus, that's good too, because we also started rotating who the host of the episode is, who starts the episode. So it ended up being a pretty good format for us to do.
See, I got good ideas sometimes.
And that's the thing we didn't really touch on a lot, is though a lot of times the ideas that we come up with to change the show, we're resistant to change because we talked a lot about habits and how important those were.
Right.
But then we are able to make pitches to each other and we trust each other with like, let's just try it. And I think with an ongoing project, it's easier just to like just try something and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And almost always when one of us comes up with something and the others are resistant, the person who came over with it was right.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's an example of that for sure.
Yes. Also, the air conditioner gets loud.
Yeah. I really wanted to mention it. We didn't. We talked about the Viking bar and all the noise that caused. But the regular thing is there's this air conditioner in here. We have to turn it off for every episode. I recorded a sample of it, and we'll put that here in the show, I suppose, and get an idea for what we have to deal with sometimes when we have to go through the noise cancellation on the episode. And you may recognize a sort of a high-pitched whine up or down, depending on if the air conditioner is on or off.
Yeah.
In the episode that cuts through that the noise canceling, that's what that is.
Yes.
If you're ever curious at what that sound is. Did we leave anything else out of the 100th episode?
I mean, I'm sure we did. We just can't think of it right now. Also, Cloudbreaker's out? Probably?
It is. Definitely.
It definitely is. Yeah.
It definitely is. Well, good
unless
job.
Something terrible happened.
Oh dear. Let's hope not. Well, good job. We did it.
Mm-hmm. High five.
Woo!
So for listeners who don't know, Clawbreaker is a game that both Stephen and Martha worked on.
Yes.
Over 2 years ago? Yes.
2015. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's why the Git project is Midwest Game Jam 2015. Yeah. So every time you open it, you're like, so long ago.
And so the team got together, polished it up. It was a game jam game,
yes.
But it was pretty much done, like complete, like a full idea. Mm-hmm. Polished it up and getting it out the door. And it's available now on Steam and Itch.
Yes. You can check it out on our website. Hopefully you had a good time at our release party that we also had. It was fun.
When was that / is going to be?
It was. It's the 17th?
Yes.
I think it's the 17th. Yes.
Okay. Well, it'll happen by the time this episode goes out. Then.
Right.
For sure. Yeah.
So it will have happened.
Cool. So yeah, hope you all had a great time.
Yes.
I probably did.
There's a tournament.
A tournament, yeah.
Some of you probably won stuff.
Yes. Good job. Hopefully it was a well-run tournament because I'm running it. So
what's that website, Stephen?
Clawbreaker.com.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's.
Cool.
Simple.
And you can search for it on Steam and itch.io.
Buy that game, guys.
Yeah. It's great, y'all.
It's selling like hotcakes.
As far as you know right now.
Yeah. Selling like crab cakes.
Uh-huh.
Hey. Better.
So a hotcake is just a pancake.
Yes.
Right?
Hot cross buns. Hot cross buns.
It is, though. I think.
I feel like I went my whole life thinking it was some old thing that doesn't exist anymore that used to sell really well.
No one calls them hotcakes. McDonald's calls them hotcakes.
Well, yeah. Then I found out they were pancakes, and I'm like, are pancakes particular good sellers? Like, is it that you need to eat a pancake really quickly when it comes off the griddle, and it sells in the sense that you can't make them fast? Is that the metaphor?
Maybe.
Or is it, I don't know, because I think what people use it for is that it's popular.
Yeah, all right.
But it might be that it's like...
Maybe someone was trying to make a new pitch for a pancake.
Could be. Could be.
Was that a subtle transfer transfer to the topic?
I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't pick up on them. Okay, our first topic today is mine. Pitching to consoles. This is something that I've been doing past couple months for Widget Satchel, and I've heard you may have heard me talk about it on the show before. And I wanted to. I'm still waiting to do the big, like, consoles topic.
Yeah.
Right? Like porting to consoles.
Yeah, it'll be
releasing, like all that stuff. That's still to come for Widget Satchel.
I'm looking forward to that too.
But this is about pitching, about that first process, right? That first step. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about pitching to all three major platform holders, and I'll reveal a little bit where we are in that process, so you know to only listen to the stuff I have any knowledge about, because I don't know about all of it just yet. Mm. It was pretty interesting. I guess we'll just get right into it. So we'll start with Sony.
Yeah.
Sony is interesting in that they are now they are the only console manufacturer you can just self-publish on.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you don't have to. They do not have to approve your game.
Oh. Okay.
You can just. I mean, just as we'll get into that.
Yeah.
but I guess you can technically self-publish on Xbox, but it's through a thing called the Xbox Creators Program, which is a there are limitations on what you can do with your application. Sure. You're limited to 1 gig of RAM.
Sure.
It has to be a UWP, which is a certain type of a binary format or package format rather for Windows apps.
Okay.
There is certain Xbox Live things you can't get. So basically. And it also goes into a separate part of the store.
Yeah.
So it's a great thing. But if you're a game dev who's taking this past hobby and into something serious, it's not really something that you're that interested in. And we'll get into Microsoft in a moment. Mm. But for Sony, and to get in the PlayStation store, you just need to do all the following things I'm going to describe. You don't need to have them approve your title. So there are things, obviously, in here that I can't talk about because of NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. Mm-hmm. And I will say, and I'll probably get into this when we revisit this topic, but I think these NDAs are restrictive for no reason. I have philosophical complaints about them. I don't think they benefit the platform holders in any way. That said, I signed them, and so there you go.
Yeah.
I will. I guess I don't respect their secrets, but I will keep them if I agreed to.
Right.
I suppose, if that makes sense.
Man of your word.
Right. So I'll probably reveal more to you than most people who are under this NDA because I've read them very carefully and I know what I'm allowed to say because it is very much my interest. And of course, it's the premise of this program is to share knowledge.
Yeah.
And I want to do as much of that as I can. If something's confusing or vague, it's probably because I don't know where the line is exactly. And I'm trying to stay safe. But you can always contact me for clarification and I can, you know, help out if possible. I think the biggest problem with these things are people who are behind that wall. Not only is it hard because it's very uncomfortable. Like you don't want to, you don't always know, so you just try to play it safe, and that's a perfectly fair thing to do because like you don't want to be in trouble, and like I do not begrudge anybody for that. But what that leads to is a lack of understanding of a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we'll talk more about this when we actually talk about the real process of it. I'm going to try to keep this to pitching, but I'm going to bleed in some other topics as well. Anyway, that's just the precursor because I feel really strongly about. The fact that information should be free and these NDAs are very much against that. And I have a lot of problems with that. But that said, I'm not going to violate them because I have an interest in keeping them. So there you go. Okay. So for Sony, you can self-publish with them, but you have to go through a process where you sign up your company and you do in fact need to pitch them the project.
Okay.
But it's basically a kind of a minimum viable sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. They do approve everything. The key thing about Sony's process is that it was built and set up for a world in which only like THQ and Activision, like the mid-tier to high-tier companies deal with them, where they have a person on staff who manages the interface with these portals. It still looks and built that way. But now it's open to anybody who can go through the rigmarole and go through all the hurdles. So that you need to understand. You need to sort of role play as a company, and not just you do actually need to have a corporate entity or an LLC or something to do it. But you need to pretend, though, that you're the rep for your corporation rather than the indie dev who's going through the process. As soon as if you get that in your mind, it comes a little bit easier, maybe not easier to do. But yeah, the main thing with them is that it's a lot of rigmarole. There's many different websites you need to have different accounts on.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a process that the step by step of it is behind the NDA.
Yeah.
So I can only basically tell you how onerous it is. Yeah, I can't really describe much of the details on it.
Okay.
And again, that's very upsetting.
Yeah. Martha, you had something to say.
Oh, I was just going to ask if you have a character sheet for your game dev rep.
Oh, yeah.
What are the stats?
Cunning 9. Like.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty good. so yeah, lots of hoops to jump through. Mm-hmm. Sony also is split into three main entities. There's Sony America, Sony Europe, Sony Japan. And when you get through this process, you do actually need to go through a lot of these steps with each one individually.
In order to get in on each of the different...
Right. So you create different... You sort of register your title in all the places you have to do it. You have to do all of those for each of the three things.
Do you have to do it for each of the stores?
If you don't want to be... If you don't want to sell in Europe, you don't have to do the... Okay. Go through it. But yeah, it is... It's there's no... There's some shared... And you know, all of the processes I've gone through... There's a sort of constant state of change. They're trying to make it better and easier. Microsoft particularly is going through a big process where they're trying to simplify their backend. And so it is difficult because documentation is kind of like talking about the old version or the new version. And you do have to dedicate a weekend to reading documents, but like before you do anything. And then the next weekend and the next weekend also. Mm. And Sony is, I think, of the ones I've seen is the... and this includes, like, Steam is included in this. I think Steam is, it's not a console, but it has a console-like process.
Right.
That you sort of go through now. Sony's is, I think, the most complicated and wonky of them in ways that you will very much throw your hands up and go, like, why is this extra step?
Yeah.
But
I mean, I feel like, I imagine that a lot of these things are based off of, like, old, like you said, with the Sony thing, it's based off of old architecture and stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
Specifically built, like, for larger companies. And now that indies are more a thing, they're trying to branch out, but like it's just going to take time for them to
get. Yeah, and a lot of times you'll see documentation that says talk to your account manager or talk to your like the person you're dealing with,
because
a lot of times with the way that the platform holders deal with companies is they do have reps that are sort of go-betweens, right? That handle them, that help them through the process. Because these backends, not only were they not designed for the indie dev, they were barely designed for the company rep. Like, really, it's more just a, like, if you have a problem, you're just supposed to ring up your guy, your account guy at Sony, and then have them help you out with it. But with self-publishing indies, that's not practical.
Right.
And so a lot of times you'll see that it says, when it says talk to your account person, this is the generic email you send, and then the team of indie reps, one of them will get back to you.
Yeah.
And I will say this for Sony, they are very good. They respond very quickly. They're very good with your weird questions. And if you don't understand something, they're pretty quick at knowing what's confusing you, because they've dealt with a lot of this.
Okay.
And that's the other thing I've found, is that there are some things that are really tedious and frustrating and annoying. But for the most part, the teams that manage the indie side of these platform holders are all like fantastic people, like doing their best. And like maybe you don't get the results you want, but like you totally can feel. I hope this isn't Stockholm syndrome, because I've gone through so much trouble that I feel I have to make it worth it. But like they're all fantastic people. The response times are pretty good. I think that's the thing you worry about when you're an indie. Like, who am I? They don't have to answer my email forever. Will they even answer my email at all?
Yeah.
But Sony and Microsoft are both really good about that.
Right.
That's been my experience.
Anyway. And it's their job to like. Answer these emails.
Exactly,
so,
right.
Like, they get paid to do
this. And it is in their interest that you do well.
Yeah, right.
So once you get over that first hurdle, it's still easy to think like you have to have something to prove to someone. But like at that point, like you are a product for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they want, it's in their interest. So like, you want to cut down on the sort of long emails that explains your motivations and everything. Just ask your question. They're there to answer it, and they're very good about that usually. So that's the rough path on Sony. There's not much to pitch because you just need to go through it. There's like one website you go to get started, and it's not even the one you'd think. So we'll put that in the show notes. I'll also sort of dig around and see if I can find some articles that try to describe that process in similarly vague terms. And if you can put all of our vague accounts together, you might have a better idea. Because that's the thing that I think would really help this process is more of people sharing their experiences, and hopefully that I'm able to help a little bit. But like I said, there's only so much you can reveal.
Right.
Okay, so Xbox is different. Xbox, Microsoft is famously a dev-friendly company.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the PC side, like they're like, hey, do you sue some crazy weird tool? We'll see if we can support it. Like they're very much, that's been the ethos of the company, even back before they became sort of popular, like culturally popular again in the past few years. Like even back when everybody hated them, in the early 2000s, they were still a really dev-friendly company. Mm. And that's definitely pervaded their Xbox team. And They have this creators program, which I've described a little bit, and I don't want to get into too much because it really is just it's pitched and meant for hobbyists.
Yeah.
That said, if you can't get in through their ID at Xbox program, their independence at Xbox, if that's something that you go for and can't get, the creator program will get your game on Xbox, and you can use your own retail Xbox as a dev kit.
Right.
You don't have to get an extra dev kit. So
it's just extra convenient.
They open this extra little door for you, but I think listeners to our show probably want more than that. So, and also, I don't have a lot of experience with that program. But I really appreciate that it exists.
Yeah.
But I tend to leave it out when I talk about how to get on Xbox.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, okay. So, what you want for Xbox is ID at Xbox. It's their program for independent developers. That is, you know, that encompasses Widget Satchel, and it also encompasses Cuphead. Cuphead is an ID at Xbox game.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have a publisher, that's the way to go. If you're a small publisher, that's the way to go. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. I don't know where the line is between ID at Xbox and like AAA Xbox exactly. It's far in the distance. ID at Xbox is a huge program, mm-hmm. and it covers a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Interestingly. And I tend to think, particularly let's say Cuphead, where Cuphead was an ID at Xbox project and remained branded that way through release. And ID at Xbox is really just it's like a back-end thing. Once you're on the store, a customer doesn't know you went through that program.
Right, yeah.
It is just the Xbox store.
They used to separate them on the Xbox 360, but right. They don't anymore.
Like Live Arcade, whatever they used to call it. And in fact, that's like the start of indie self-publishing. And that's what the Creators Program now is. Mm-hmm. It's a separate sort of part of the store for that. And that's probably not ideal for a lot of creators. But ID at Xbox is just the program that you go through the process. Once you're in the store, you're in the same store as Call of Duty and all that stuff. My thinking is that it's a bit of a branding exercise for some of those flagship indie titles where they get in through ID at Xbox and then they get a lot more first party support, but they just are continued to be called an ID at Xbox game.
Sure.
I don't have a problem with that exactly, but it does help to be maybe sort of practical, realistic about what it really means. That's a huge digression. Anyway, with ID at Xbox, you sign up with your Microsoft account and you have to pitch them your company. And the reason I'm a little vague on this is because there's two steps. There's pitching them that you're a real company that exists and runs to make games. And then you get into the program. Then you pitch your game. And when you pitch only after your game is approved, do you get access to dev kits, back-end portals, all that stuff. So I submitted my company, Noble Robot, to ID at Xbox like 3 years ago. And you know, got into that where you get like monthly newsletters basically. But there's no website to go to. There's nothing to log into. It's not really part of it. So when I was looking into doing this for Widget Satchel, I'd forgotten that I was part of the program to some degree. Usually you just want to do one after the other, right? Anyway, that's why I'm a little vague on that origin part of it. But I think it's just developer@xbox.com. So we'll put all the links in the show notes. Where you just sign up, and as far as I know, the requirements for that first step are fairly low. It's like a prove you exist kind of thing. I think it does ask you, or at least it did when I did it, I believe, if my memory serves, it asks you to write a little bit like, what kind of projects do you want to make? What are you up to? Like, you know, but it's not, you don't have to submit screenshots or proper game design, any of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's mostly just introductory.
Right.
Anyways. The game information form, that's the unhelpfully acronymed GIF. Like,
oh boy.
They, on the forums.
Is it GIF or GIF?
Don't start with me. Well, actually, I don't know for that one because it's not referring to the same thing.
Yeah.
In the back end forums, people will talk about like the GIF. And I'm like, what? Like, oh, right. The game information form.
Yeah.
This is what you submit to, once you're in the program, they give you, at least it used to be. They actually changed it. So when I signed up, I got a link that said, hey, now that you're part of the program, here's your individualized link to the game information form. And I had to go digging for that email.
Mm.
And when I clicked it, the whole process had changed. So I think it actually is a public URL, but you have to log in with the account that's approved. Anyways, that's sort of wonky and not interesting. But you'll be sent an email with this link. It won't be the same one I got, but it'll be a similar one. And it is just basically a web form that is relatively long, but what's great is it's totally step by step.
Cool.
It asks like, you know, other platforms you're going to want this game on, describe the sort of blurb, the hook, give us a gameplay information. Like none of this is not under NDA, but it's still behind the program. So I'm going to be a little respectful to it. But it's also not interesting that you know every detail of it. It basically just asks a lot of details about it, and then it asks you for additional materials that you can submit to them. Now, things like a demo, a trailer, screenshots, none of that, you cannot submit that on this form. But it's very much recommended, and the Xbox people I talked to when I went to GDC before I submitted our information form were very clear on, yes, you want to put that stuff in there.
Okay.
And I'll talk a little bit about the sort of like minimum things you need for all of this later. But it basically is a really helpful form, and what's nice about it is that that lets you organize all of your thoughts in a way that helps you pitch to other platform holders. Also, it lets you put your materials in a way that will help you with an elevator pitch to, say, a publisher or something like that.
That's
so
good.
The best thing about doing more than one of these, I have found, is that you end up having materials you can reuse in another, and then it refines your message. It refines, like, the Xbox form asks you what the hook of your game is, and nothing else asks for that, right, in that exactly that way. And so asking you for these details in slightly different ways, because it all comes from different sources, allows you to get to the core of what the answers are.
Yeah.
And it's really, really useful.
That's good. Okay.
And so we now have this materials for Widget Satchel that are like just in a bag we can just grab for anyone who needs anything.
Yeah.
It's really useful. So when we start doing press and try to get do some press relations for this game, we are going to have a lot ready to go.
Yeah.
And that is a huge service it provides to you, even if like the process doesn't go as well as you think. Mm-hmm. You end up having a lot of this stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that seems really useful that like you have all of that information and you can just use it to pitch it to article writers and such.
Yeah, exactly right.
Just so you can get your game out there. That's good.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it is a pitch in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the game information form, you get all that stuff going and then you send it off. And then I think it's like they say like 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, they expect to get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
I made the mistake of sending it to them the week of E3.
Oh, yeah.
Microsoft's also really good with email. They actually will do it. They do auto replies to let you know, like, thanks for sending it. This is who you sent it to. This is what we normally respond. And so they, you know, it is very disheartening to send an email into the void. It's like, it's stress you don't need. And so Microsoft's pretty good about like letting you know exactly like we got it. Here's what we're doing with it. And
That's good.
And you know, a lot of things are like that, but they do a pretty good job with this. Mm-hmm. So their message then was like, hey, it's E3. So FYI, it's going to be a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
But good news. It actually didn't. It took like, I don't know, like 8-9 business days before they got back.
That's good.
And I'd like to think that that's not a function of like how great our game was. I'm trying to make that assumption when we go through these things is that like that we are a typical indie game team.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have the confidence that we actually are a little better than that. But I try not to assume that because I think it's like, because I don't want to think of it as super special. And that's the other thing about back to the sort of NDA talk is when you get past this NDA wall, you feel special. And I think that's kind of an unhealthy feeling. It becomes exclusionary and you start to think that you've accomplished something. You're better than someone else. But like, we all know, like, it's the people at Microsoft have a good idea of what a good game is, but they're not the arbiters of that, right? Sure. Like, they have their own reasons for choosing things.
Yeah.
Like, too many RPGs this month, or whatever. You have no idea.
Yeah, right? I don't know, I guess.
They also don't have a fancy energy sword, so.
Good point.
If I was under NDA, I would feel more worried than special, I think.
Fair enough. Worried first.
Yeah.
That being said, there is nothing wrong with feeling, I mean, I am very proud to have the process of the approval process anyway, has gone pretty smooth for us so far. That does give me some pride, but I try to be realistic and think it's just emotionally prideful, but at the same time, I don't want it to change my behavior.
Right.
And I don't want it to, I don't ever want to tell someone, yeah, we went through this process, you might have some trouble, but like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I want to cast myself as the typical person that goes through this because I don't know any different.
Yeah.
And so I think it is important to keep that in check. I don't know how valuable that is to hear for our listeners, but like, I think it is, sometimes you feel like it's like a club on the other side of the fence that has access to consoles. When this day and age, it's really not that special.
I think that, it has changed a lot.
Yeah.
It used to be more exclusionary and stuff just because like it was very difficult and expensive.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Cause it was cost and technical expertise were very much different.
Yes.
Whereas these days we have so much like really groundbreaking middleware and the platform holders are so good at letting a lot of different types of games. This isn't just like Unity doing all the work. This is the platform holders really opening it up. So it's like, they're the ones who've done the work
right.
to make themselves less exclusionary, but the process still feels that way.
Yeah.
And that does bother me a little
bit. Sure. Yeah. I think a lot of it is just like, that's how it used to be. And like, it's just going to take some time for the idea of getting on the consoles to change.
I mean, truthfully, it's a system that works. It works for them. Mm-hmm. So like, they don't have a lot of motivation to change it, so I don't really blame them. Mm-hmm. But also they do, you know, like I said, they are really good at communicating with the people that are, you know, through the process.
Yeah.
But that means that number does have to be kind of small then. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons for this. And like, Sony lets you self-publish. Xbox has a game information form that they have said they want more and more indie games. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, as long as in your form you can prove to them that you can follow through on creating your vision, I don't think they care what your vision is. I don't think I don't think they have like quotas for genres or anything. They may have at one point, but the reps I've talked to before we went through the process have said that, like, you know, we really want more and more on there. And but part of the reason they do that check, I'll get to, is that they actually do provide you with monetary resources for getting through that. So it actually, they do need to actually check. And then on Nintendo's side, Nintendo is much more locked down. They're very much a black box as to how they decide what games are on their platform. They're much more interested in curating which types of games come out when, and they're much more hands-on with that. And the fact that all three of them have different approaches, I think is great. I think it's also, as each generation changes, the consoles will change what their thresholds are.
Yeah.
Like Xbox Live Arcade was huge for Xbox.
Right.
Before they launched ID at Xbox, their strategy was just to let everybody in. And then Xbox Live Arcade got a pretty prominent place in the store. It wasn't this little side thing.
Yeah.
Whereas PS3 didn't really have any way for an indie to get on there unless they were personally invited. At least that changed toward the end of that cycle. Mm. It almost flipped, in a sense, in 2013 with the new consoles, and that a lot had to do with their market position. But that is just, like, the more players there are, the more approaches there can be. So if you're a player who is like, oh, I hate that anyone can just put a stupid game on Steam or whatever, well, then you want a more locked-down, curated thing.
Right.
And if you're a developer, you might feel the opposite. But also, if you're a player, you want more interesting, crazy things. There's enough of a variance between the platform holders. I do kind of wish they were all the same and you could just do through one process. Mm. But part of me, I like the healthy change and the fact that it changes over time. So Nintendo's policies will change and Xbox's policies will change over time.
Well, also,
I think that's healthy and good.
Also, these policies will, like, they curate like the games that are on the platforms. So the platforms have their own little personalities based off of the games that they have.
Yes. So. And that certainly, I think, was probably much more, that particular angle is still important. But I think it was much more important longer ago.
Sure.
I think it's, what we, as developers, what we really want is we really want an arms race between the platform holders to get as many indie games as possible. Mm-hmm. And we're not far from that. Mm-hmm. They just have a slightly different approaches to it, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much Microsoft for the pitching process. And then the last bit is, the other thing is, what Xbox does like to see a certain number of things. They have a couple of unique platform features. All the platform holders want you to tell them what you're going to do for them, right? How use their special features. Microsoft's is really interesting. They have Windows cross-publishing. So you can, especially with a middleware solution like Unity or Unreal, you can publish a game to Windows and Xbox One day and date. You can do cross saves. You can even do cross play. Mm-hmm. And it's not that APIs are not that complicated. Microsoft wants to hear that from you. I don't think they have a problem if you don't want to do that. Like, you're just like, I just want to release an Xbox game. I don't want to bother with the extra.
You just look better if you do it that way, right?
Yeah, you come off better to them if you say, like, hey, we're going to use your particular platform features.
Right.
And, you know, so that's something to keep in mind as well.
And that's the case with, like, all of the platforms, really, is that, like, you just want to make sure that, like, your game will look more attractive on this console if you're able to use the console's features. So, like, if your game is really good if every once in a while, like, if you can just jump into the game real quick and play, like, for 5 minutes and stop, mm-hmm. it'd be good on Switch because Switch is portable.
Yeah.
And so, like, you can use that to your advantage when you're telling Nintendo that we wanted to sell your game on this.
Exactly right. Yeah. If you're releasing like a real time strategy game that is very PC friendly.
Yeah.
Well, Xbox is a good platform for that because it's really easy to do cross play.
Yes.
On that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to focus on those things that even if they're different for each platform, even if you can't think of why your game. It's also good to you're making a pitch, so you're not making a promise. So one of the things that we did in ours is we talked about Mixer integration. Mixer is Microsoft's, it's basically Twitch, but Microsoft, it's a different company and Microsoft bought them a couple of years ago. They have done a really good job of making Mixer like a really good platform for developers, it's still a smaller audience. And so they can be a little bit more curatorial with how that they're building the culture in a way where Twitch was just this runaway thing that just formed out of a big mass of the people using it. Mm-hmm. Mixer feels a little bit more like a planned community. Like they're trying to establish how Mixer feels before it gets too big, which is kind of cool. And they have tons of really great interactive features where you can build controls in your game that appear on a website where you're watching someone stream it, and then you can interact directly with that game. And that's something that, like, we thought for Widget Satchel could have a couple of interesting ideas. But in the form, I just sort of pitched a couple of, we could do this, or we could do this, we could do this. I didn't promise that we would get around to that, because that's the other thing. You don't want to oversell yourself. You want to say exactly what your game is.
Yeah.
You don't want to say, like, this game is a cool idea and maybe it could be the next big seller. Like, that's not something they're going to take seriously.
I'm going to make the next Minecraft.
Right, exactly. Like, you want to tell them your honest aspirations for it. And we talked about this in the indie game success episode. It's sometimes hard to wrap your head around what you think success will be.
Yeah.
And there's a balance between being overly modest and being a little bit too blowfishy, pumping up your chest a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit, everyone's going to have to figure out how to do that on their own. But it's important to, you are pitching it to them, but like you're not going to fool them. Mm-hmm. So when you want to say like, oh, well, I would love to use all of Xbox's great unique features or all of Nintendo's great unique features like this and this. No other game is going to be as unique as this. It's like, they're not going to buy that.
Yeah.
Like, tell them like that what you're honestly excited about their platform and what you think would be good for your game.
Right.
Not what you think would be good for all the Xbox games.
Right.
Right. Like, and yeah, it's not that hard. It's just easy to overthink it perhaps and try to think that there's a certain requirement. Mm-hmm. But the more honestly you can answer these things and meeting those conditions, the better. Okay, so Nintendo is the last one on this list, and it's the last one because it's the one that Widget Satchel has not gone through yet. So I guess we'll announce it. Widget Satchel is coming to PlayStation and Xbox One.
Yay!
At some point, we want to say end of this year, but we're not going to promise that yet. No, yeah. Release date announced.
Yeah.
But it's in the works. It will come out on those platforms as well as on PC. We've pitched as a Nintendo. Mm-hmm. And normally, this is not a thing you would even reveal until you've gone through that process, but I don't mind saying we've pitched this game to Nintendo.
Yeah.
It was only a couple weeks ago. Actually, like a week and a half ago. So we haven't heard back yet, and that's how it goes.
3 weeks ago, yeah. Your time.
Yeah, yes. That's right. So maybe by the time you hear this, we'll have heard back.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. So the thing with Nintendo is, they have a website called developer.nintendo.com. And a couple of years ago, I went through this process where I signed up for them and said, hey, I want to be a Nintendo developer. This was during the middle Wii U years, right? Or year, because Wii U had a pretty short life cycle. And I got a phone call from Nintendo telling me, hey, yes, you're in this program now. And I'm like, oh, great. Why do you make phone calls? And this was when I was thinking about Metro Nexus.
Yeah.
And even at that time, I knew that like porting Metro Nexus to consoles was going to be difficult. But I just sort of had this is probably the same time I submitted for Xbox, ID Xbox, is I'm just like, you know, I'll just see how this goes, right? And deal with the technical problems later. And so I talked to one of the reps on the phone, and just, it was kind of cool to get a call from Nintendo and say, hey, you're this now. That is not the way it is anymore. Mm. And actually, this is probably for the better. The developer.nintendo.com site you can go to, and you can just sign up, and there's no restrictions. They will give you access almost immediately. But it is limited to Wii U and 3DS. Mm. Now, Wii U is, I couldn't recommend anybody develop for Wii U right now. And a lot of people who are in the process of a Wii U game that they started working on a year or 2 years ago, like, it's kind of a tough moment for them. Mm. Those people probably have a better chance of convincing Nintendo to give them access to Switch dev hardware, but it was a very, very short life cycle for that product, and Nintendo is pretty happy to, because it sold so little, they're happy to let it move on, whereas right. 3DS has been around forever, but the install base is enormous. They are not, there's very few first-party titles coming for 3DS. But it's not a bad idea to publish on 3DS.
Yeah, it is. It's a good idea, largely because there's so many people playing it.
Yep. And there are, you know, if you're a Unity developer, you can develop Unity. There are some caveats. It's not fully updated, the editor, but like all those details are available to you when you get through this. This is also an NDA process, but again, anyone can sign up. Mm-hmm. But technically, you can't really say anything about it until you sign up, so it's kind of weird. But I can say that 3DS test kits, they're not dev kits, but you can test a build on them. They're relatively cheap. So if you have a game you think, like a mobile game you think would do it on 3DS, and you got a couple months to spare and a little bit of money, and you'd like access to that install base, probably the best way, the quickest way to get on console. But it's not really well advertised. It's also not that sexy of a way to get on consoles, because it's a pretty old platform, and releasing a new game on it doesn't sound that fun. But if you think you got a nice little gem that could work on a smaller device, lower powered, go for it. I think it's a cool idea. I'm tempted. I have a couple of little puzzle games from my like old Flash design days, and I'm like, maybe bring those out of the drawer.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got too much to do right now. But okay, so that's Wii U and 3DS. That is also where you can get access to the developer forums, where you can get a lot of help from them. There's Nintendo people are still there hanging out, giving advice. Now, the real thing everyone wants to know is how to get on Switch, right? Because that's really all there is. That's the only game console in the world, as far as a lot of us are concerned. That's what you really want. And the Nintendo's official policy is just send us an email. That is their official policy. They have a, if you go to any of the Nintendo reps, like Twitter accounts, they'll that's like their pinned tweet. It's like, just send us an email. That's all they want. I went to a developer roundtable kind of thing, like a little meeting of people at GDC this year and last year that Nintendo held at in their little business area of GDC. And it was kind of fun to get. This was the 2 years ago. It was actually a week before the Switch came out. So they had a Nintendo rep, and there was like eight of us just sort of asking information. And he's like, I can't tell you anything. And so it was kind of, and in the end, it was just send us an email. So there wasn't any. Like even, there were people there who were like longtime publishers on Nintendo platforms, and saying like, "How do we get access to Switch hardware? Like we've been publishing. We have 6 3DS games. That just send us an email."
Yeah,
like it really isn't. You're all on level playing field at that point.
And so, in the email and the contents of the email is largely just a pitch, like in the other ones, right?
You'd think, but they have no official stance on this. Now you know, like you can ask people who've gone through the process, and my feeling is that people who have successfully pitched Nintendo have done different things to do it, but generally. What you want to send is an introductory email.
Yeah.
You don't want to send the whole everything.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because if you're like me, you've made a lot of materials for Sony, a lot of materials for Microsoft. You now have a lot of materials. Mm-hmm. What are you going to send to Nintendo? Again, they want to know what's interesting about their platform features. And from what I heard directly from them is they want to know a little bit more about your business plan. They want to know like where your game is in the market. They don't want to hear necessarily how great your game is. They do want to hear that. But they also want to know like, you know, where would this, why would we put this in our Switch lineup? Why would we like, you know, put this on, you know, on our YouTube channel with all the other indie games? How does this complete our little puzzle? And so that is something they want to hear. Now, from what we've heard from people who have gone through the process, a couple of different people, it's a bit of a back and forth with Nintendo. When you do hear back from them, they will probably ask you for more. And that is when you prepare more, but they will be more specific at that point. Now we haven't got to that point with widget satchel yet, so this is all just things I've heard from others. But my understanding is, you know, it really just send them an email. That's kind of it.
Cool.
You don't have to be as scared of it. I mean, time will tell out if our approach worked. But you know, again, there might be reasons they don't, you know, choose to go forward with it. I've also heard from people when they are denied, they actually do get an email back from Nintendo saying like, no, thank you. And sometimes it's a advice on how to what we would want to see from a game like this, or how to maybe prepare your pitch for next time, or this isn't far enough in development for us. I've heard a couple of those stories. So when they say just send you an email, it sounds really like that's no information at all, but that literally is what they want you to do.
They just want you to start a conversation.
It isn't any more complicated than that.
Okay.
Yeah. Even now, it still feels like there's some secret like unlockable thing to it.
Yeah.
But like, even I still feel that, but it really, there isn't. So we're still waiting. And you know, at a certain point, you know, they get a lot of emails. So maybe I'll send a follow-up because sometimes that's what it takes. Cause they're not ignoring you. You know, if they didn't get back, it's, you know, it's because like they're busy probably. So we'll see how that goes. And hopefully I'd like to report good news on that. But that's the aim. And there's, when you think about it, like take a real self-assessment. Like if you think about the games that are on Switch, can your game fit alongside those? Like, your assessment is probably good enough. That's my feeling. It's my gut feeling. Is that like Widget Satchel would be great on Switch. So we just need to navigate this.
Yeah.
I don't fear that they're going to not like it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I mean, if you have that fear legitimately, then maybe you have different problems than we do. But I don't know. That's pretty much the pitching process.
Yeah.
And I still feel like it's not a lot of information. Like, hopefully it should reassure you a little bit.
I mean, it seems like a lot of information to me.
Yeah?
Like, I learned a lot about the whole... Like, I'm involved in Widget Satchel, obviously, but I haven't been involved in the pitching process of it, so...
That's true.
All of this information sounds really useful, I think. It's very valuable stuff. And, like, the wall seems less tall.
Yeah,
to scale
yeah.
Up.
It doesn't seem as intimidating. It's like, oh, I can send emails. I do that every day.
right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I guess that's the key message. Is that like, you know, like Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, they are big important companies, but like there are things about this environment of console production that make it seem even more inscrutable than it actually is. Mm-hmm. It is fairly inscrutable. But, you know, so hopefully that will give you the confidence. Like everything we talk about in this show, like it's, you can do it.
Yeah.
You can do it.
I believe in you.
Yeah.
Believe.
So I do want to talk a little bit more about just the little other details before we move on. Dev kits, just simple facts about dev kits so you know what you're getting into. Sony, you got to buy those dev kits. They expensive. But not as bad as you might think. Certainly not as bad as the old days. And that is about as specific as I can get. You can find a lot of other accounts online of around that. And they'll probably say exactly what I say. The way Sony themselves says it, which now that seems fair to say, is they say it's about the cost of like a high-end laptop. Is what a PS4 dev kit is.
Okay.
So if you can imagine that, and it's a pretty narrow range. And this is another case where like it is ridiculous that I can't just say this number. Like it serves no one that I can't say it. But I can't say it. Anyways, but that's what Sony says. This is it's about the cost of a high-end laptop. And that's more money than you probably want to spend on a PS4 dev kit. But if you want to publish on PS4, it's worth it. And now the thing about dev kits that is true for all three of these manufacturers is that there are two types of dev kits. There's the dev kit, which is usually a much higher end version of the console, extra RAM, sometimes an extra piece of processor, sometimes extra hard drives or different partitions, or like, again, those details are under NDA, a lot of them. But they're totally different machines, and they can emulate a retail box for you to test on, but also they're much more powerful so that you can run unoptimized projects and get things working, as well as get much more like debugging information. And this is probably not news to a lot of people. But there's another type of dev kit that people probably aren't as familiar with. It's called a test kit. And a test kit, they'll be called different things by different manufacturers or different platform holders. But the test kit is basically a retail device with like a switch flipped, where you can deploy. So they usually can't run retail games. So you can't run your own personal games on it. That's true for most of them. But you can deploy your products on it. You can do limited debugging with them. But they have basically the same capabilities of a retail thing. Now, if you're a Unity developer, you do a lot of your debugging on your PC,
yeah.
And a test kit is kind of good enough for a lot of cases. This is why I was recommending a 3DS development, because 3DS dev kits, like proper dev kits, very expensive. Mm. But a test kit, incredibly affordable. Mm-hmm. That is not going to be a barrier if you want to put your game on 3DS, is getting a test kit.
Okay.
And a test kit can get you most of the way there. The problem is like if you don't have a proper dev kit, there's some things you can't check for completely. It depends on what your workflow is. But if you're a Unity developer, if you're one really reliant on middleware, then test kits can get you, you can get away with that without getting a proper dev kit. And so that is something that not a lot of people know, and is also not, that fact is not under NDA. Mm-hmm. But it's still one of those things that people don't talk about because so much of it is sort of clouded in mystery. So Sony's very expensive. Xbox, free. So when you get your game approved by ID at Xbox, they send you dev kits, and that's cool. They send you two dev kits because they're like, you know, you're like, wow, that seems like a lot. Well, I think my thinking is that they don't know how big your team is,
so they
don't want to even ask you. They're just like, everyone gets two.
You get two dev kits. You get two.
Exactly. So if you're a single developer, that's one more dev kit than you need.
Yeah.
But if you're a small team, then like that's kind of great, right? And so that's that. Nintendo's, it's like Sony's where you have to buy them. But they're, and I, this is what they told me, is that they're much cheaper. And I think there was a lot of stories, when the Switch came out,
yeah,
that made it to the popular mainstream games press talking about how cheap the dev kits are. Mm-hmm. Nintendo also has a dev kit and a test kit. And it's basically the same kind of thing where you have much more power and then ones that are closer to retail. And now what they do recommend the process for all the platform manufacturers is you want to develop on your dev kit, you want to do QA on your test kit. Mm-hmm. And so really what they will recommend you, and if you ask them different, like, could I just get it? The party line is always, we want you to have both. Yeah. But the dev kit does both, so you can get away with just that.
Okay.
But you can make your own assessment as to how badly you need the full power of a straight-up dev kit.
Sure.
That said, if you submit your game then to certification, which is the process that all the platform holders have for approving a final binary to go in the store, much more rigorous than it is on Steam or other PC platforms. You know, you're more likely to fail it if you don't have the tools to do all that checking. So again, it's a calculated risk that you make.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to do that with Microsoft because those things is free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice. So those are just basic facts. This is also not terrible. It's not news. I think a lot of people know that those details about the sort of Microsoft very frequently they'll say, hey, make a game for Xbox, you get free dev kits. Like, yeah. They advertise that fact, for sure. Okay, so other things is the forums and the communities by these things. Is also where you get information on, like, how do I do Unity stuff? All of that, a lot of it is under NDA forums. So sometimes they'll be the platform holder will have their own forum that you go to. Other times, Unity or other middleware developers will have a sub-forum that you go to that is monitored by the platform holder staff. It's okay. Kind of different for each platform okay. holder and for different middlewares.
Okay.
So it's getting that all set up, getting yourself access to those things is another one of those, like, once you get through, you kind of have to, like, wait for a couple of other emails to go around that you're not part of to get you access to certain things. Mm. That's the thing I was not prepared for as much as ended up happening was how many times I had to wait for someone else to do something
mm-hmm.
just to log into a thing. Very crazy. But you have to be patient with that stuff because it is an old system, right? It is slowly adapting.
Yeah, yeah.
But the key about it is that a lot of the information is, it's not super complete. They're not terribly active, the forums, because
there's not that many people on.
There's not that many people.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, especially with middleware, people are solving their problems on the main forums. And it is it's another reason I don't like this NDA thing, because the information on that forum, it's not top secret. It's not that interesting. It's just people talking about technical things, looking for an API call, all the things you find on a normal tech, you know, Stack Overflow or the Unity forums or anything. But you have to be prepared for it to be a little harder to find what you need. Mm. And if you're like kind of person who like lurks on forums, you just search for a question that you think is already asked, you need to get over that a little bit and start asking a bunch of questions. And that can be a bit of a habit change for a lot of people.
Okay.
I feel like I'm a person who posts questions, but I realize like even I only post like 5% of the times I have a problem. Mm. 95% of the time, I'm just searching for someone else who already solved it.
Yeah.
And
because you don't want to do the work of asking the question,
exactly,
waiting
right.
for the answer.
And this is definitely a time where you'll be like, oh, I really got to actually start. I got to start being part of this wheel turning.
Yeah.
Or else this information will not show itself.
Okay.
But you'll find everyone's in the same boat as you. So people are happy to share information. But again, not only is it a smaller amount of people, it's not as well trafficked as other forums. So you have to be incredibly patient with your fellow users on these forums. And you have to hope for communication with the platform holders if your problem rises to the level that their technical people would want to be interested in answering that and not just directing to the forums. Both Sony and Microsoft are pretty good at that, but I think I've tried to be, when I had technical questions, I try to be really respectful of their time and not just pepper them with everything I had.
Sure.
Like, just spend a couple more hours trying to figure it myself before bothering them with it. And I don't know that that's necessary. I think they would probably be happier to answer more questions, but I want to make sure that until we go further through the process, I don't want to test what those limits are.
Sure.
Because I've had a pretty good experience so far, and I don't want to test it yet. I guess my point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Last thing is just a quick note on business entities. You definitely need one. I have a single member LLC for Noble Robot, which means that I file my taxes as me. I don't file my taxes as the company, but the company is a separate legal entity. I keep a separate bank account for the company. I purchase things with that money. But for tax purposes, it's just my social security number. It's the simplest way to do these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. We did a whole episode on this.
Yes.
And I described the process of forming this LLC.
Yeah, I was going to say, yep.
And I know, Steven, you've been looking into forming a partnership with the Escape Industries folks.
Maybe.
You've been putting it off.
Well, yeah.
I think everybody does that.
Yeah.
Right? You, all you listeners out there who want to form a company and hasn't yet, it's because it's not fun and you don't need it right now.
True. Both of those things.
You need it for this.
Well, okay.
yeah, that's something. And, you know, you need a website, you need a presence, right? Mm. Nintendo particularly is concerned about this, that you are actually a thing that's going to exist in a year.
Yeah.
That you're not just making a game to see if it works.
Yeah.
That you actually are in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
And these things are signs of that. Maybe that's not fair, but it's the truth. Mm. One thing that came up recently that I wanted to mention, it's not super relevant to my experience, but Glitch, who hosts us here in the clubhouse, They are a nonprofit organization. They've also started what they're describing as an independent game label, kind of like a record label. And there's going to be a couple games that they're going to publish. But as a nonprofit entity, they're having a lot of trouble getting access to, right. to the consoles.
Yeah.
Because those systems, again, they're pretty old, mm-hmm. and at least the way that they're set up. And they're just, it just didn't occur to them to allow for that. So sometimes it's just not, there's like not a checkbox on the form for like filing as a 501c or something like that. Mm-hmm. Even though there's no legal problem with selling, with a nonprofit selling something on a commercial store, that is legal, right? Uh-huh. But these platform holders are just not prepared for that.
Sure.
And what's great is there's actually been a couple of really good articles just where we're sitting just in the last couple of days talking about glitches situations specifically. Polygon has a really good one. So we'll link that in the show notes. And you can hear a little bit about the two games that Glitch is publishing. Hyper Dot, which is by Steven's brother, Charles.
Yes, the Perpetual Student.
And Optica by Gravik, which is a company that's based here at Glitch.
Yes.
Those games are going to be published through Glitch. And there is a sort of an unexpected bureaucratical hang-up, which is sort of tragic. Mm. And hopefully there'll be some attention to this and maybe some of that stuff can get changed.
Yeah.
And we can get those. Those are both games that would be great on Switch.
It's true.
Okay, well, my mouth is really dry now.
You want to get some water and come back?
I'm good. I think we can move on to the next topic, but is there any questions you guys have? Because I really just motor mouth through this whole thing.
That's okay. Well, I think, like I said, I think that this was all really useful to hear because, like, I when we first started with Vengeance, I never thought that, like, I could even think about putting it on consoles because I thought
talk about games that'd be great on Switch.
I know. Vengeance would be wonderful on Switch, but like it always seemed really scary because like it always seemed like it was a huge involved process and like you had to make sure your game was top notch or something like that. And like I just didn't understand the process, but like hearing all of these things makes it feel a lot more accessible.
Yeah, yeah,
And that's good.
I think it
that's
is good. A huge involved process,
sure,
but that should not stop you.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, making games is a huge involved process,
right? Yeah, you're already a crazy person.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, thanks for that.
Yeah. Martha, you're a PC gamer mostly, so this might not even excite you the way it excites like the child and me.
Definitely does for Nintendo.
Oh, yeah?
Like, yeah. Super cool.
Yeah. Well, we talked in the success episode, you were describing like a game on a shelf, like as a sign of having made it. Like having something on a Nintendo platform as a person who grew up with video games. That's it, right?
Yeah. That would be pretty cool.
And I don't mind that they weaponized that nostalgia. Like,
I mean, that describes a lot of what Nintendo does.
Yeah, pretty much.
You liked this before? You'll like it 5 more times. Well, I think it's my turn now.
I think so.
Okay, I got that one. I picked up on it.
It was very subtle and clever. My topic is turn-based RPGs.
Ooh.
Because I've been playing so much Octopath Traveler recently.
I've heard things about that game. It seems like mixed reviews.
It's very fun. The stories are kind of meh.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But the gameplay is very fun.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe talk a little bit about like history of them. Mm-hmm. They kind of started out as video game ports of D&D or other role like tabletop role playing pen and paper sort of things, because those had turns and you had skills that did a certain number of points, and so it was like super easy to make really simple video games like text-based adventures and stuff like that.
Right.
So you didn't need very many graphics, and then other characteristics that get carried over from like D&D sort of things are like quests and campaigns where you have a story and you have to go travel somewhere and do something.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way you get attacked by things, yeah. Basically, or you attack things random.
That's really interesting. Like when you think about like the video game RPG cliches, mm-hmm. they all are from like pen and paper, like stopping in a town,
yeah,
random encounters, like all that stuff. It's amazing how it's just the exact same language.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, they're based off of them. Like,
the feel of playing them is totally different, but mechanically they're almost identical.
Yeah.
I don't know. That shouldn't be a surprise, but it feels like a kind of a surprise to me.
Well, I think the one thing that pulls you that really separates them is that even though you're playing a role, and in a lot of some games you can choose like your dialogue options or whatever, you're not really, it's just different embodying the character than when you're actually having to come up with everything about them.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can come up with more of the story in pen and paper ones, because there's not actually the computer program has set up a certain way and you can't change the story once it's already going unless it's online or something.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. I've definitely found in the D&D campaigns that I've been a part of, there's less of the thing that happens in the first scene is pivotal to the end climax. Whereas RPG stories, video game RPG stories, are much more like movies where they have, because there's so much more control.
Yeah.
In a tabletop, it much more feels like anything can happen, and that's part of their charm.
Yeah. And you can ignore side... Well, I guess you can ignore side quests in each of them. But there are side quests in a lot of them. Mm-hmm. That's a trope in a lot of them, too. You have items and an inventory of items, and you get loot and new weapons and yes. upgrades to things, and that includes like your powers and character classes. So mm-hmm. each character has a different personality and different powers that you, as you level up, you get more of them. And you usually are playing, well, some of them you're only playing one person, but most of them you're like have a party.
Yeah, right, right.
Right, it makes the player a different person. In a way that's,
yeah, it's like you're the manager.
Yeah. Yeah, that is accurate. It's weird though, because oftentimes you play as the character but also as the party. You get to decide what the party does and what your character does outside of
combat. you're the lead character, and then the party is
also you.
there's apparently two different styles of RPGs, so like Western RPGs and Japanese RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but I guess I haven't considered that in a turn-based RPG kind of setting. Western RPGs is like Skyrim, when things are like open-ended and the open-world things, right?
Right, they tend to be like action games with numbers.
Yep.
Right?
Yes.
And then that's kind of funny, interesting, because the pen and paper role-playing game is an American invention,
mm-hmm.
right? It comes out of Wisconsin. But the Japanese RPG is very much more associated. Oh, yeah?
D&D?
Yeah.
Yeah, Minnesota.
I thought it was Wisconsin.
No, that's propaganda.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to give us the whole treatise on that.
Yes.
But the turn-based RPGs are much more associated with Japanese developers.
Yes.
I'm really curious to know where those, you know.
I think it kind of makes sense because like Dungeons & Dragons is a more open world, you do whatever the heck you want kind of mm-hmm. thing. And a lot of the Western RPGs, that's what Western RPGs are, open world, you do whatever the heck you want kind of things. Whereas JRPGs are more, they're more, you know, linear, I guess. Like you do this one thing. There's side things you can do, but like there's a main story, and it's not as much about exploration.
I suppose. I just mean like the developers of Final Fantasy. Like a lot of people think that, you know, there's like Final Fantasy Dragon Quest invented a genre.
Oh, but sure.
In fact, all they did is translate a genre. Like, did they play D&D? I really want to know.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know how that. In the late 70s, early 80s, like how those ideas cross continents in a time before the internet.
You know? I like that. That's a good question. I don't have an answer, but
I don't either. Final Fantasy, the first one, came out in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Final Fantasy is kind of like the one everyone knows.
Yeah.
And there's like...
I wonder if that's different in Japan, because there's Dragon Quest.
Which is much more popular in Japan.
Is it?
Really? Yeah. Interesting.
Did that come out before or after Final Fantasy?
I think before, but I don't know for certain.
Yeah.
I know that it came out in America as Dragon Warrior mm-hmm. because of a copyright or a trademark issue. Mm-hmm. And it sold so poorly that they gave it away for free in copies of Nintendo Power.
Yep.
Wow.
I told the story in the show before. That's how I played that game.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, terrible, but awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So then Dragon Quest is now, I think, popular here, but only more recently. It's like a cultural institution in Japan, mm-hmm. but it didn't catch on early on. Whereas Final Fantasy, cultural institution here also.
Yeah.
Right?
It's true. There's now 15 of them, I think.
That's a really conservative estimate.
Right, because there's spinoffs and whatnot, too.
Yeah, and ones that have spun off into different genres of games.
Yeah.
Like tactical RPGs, which is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
But also turn-based.
Right.
So, but it's much more about controlling, because so in the normal turn-based RPG, in battles, basically what happens is you have the enemy and you have your party, and it doesn't really matter. Well, in some of them it matters what order you're in, but it doesn't really matter like where your characters are standing mm-hmm. most of the time. And it's mostly about doing a sort of war thing, picking which ability will be the best against this thing, whatever your enemy is,
right.
Whatever your Pokemon you're fighting is. Another famous RPG.
Mm-hmm.
So with a tactical RPG, all your characters are out on a chessboard, basically, and you have to strategically put your characters in places for their abilities to do the most damage, or if you can get behind your enemy, you can do more damage, or there's abilities that only go to certain tiles around you. So basically like the different chess pieces, but on steroids.
I've always preferred that kind of mechanics. I like turn-based RPGs, but everyone I play is kind of just throwing numbers at each other until all the numbers are gone. But tactical ones feel like there's a lot more. I mean, even ones that are meant for you to pretty much win, like the early stages, they still feel really engaging because you feel like you're making a lot more interesting choices.
And I just want to like 3D print all of the stages for like Final Fantasy Tactics, their little stages are where you battle are basically cutouts of like little Polly Pocket, like, miniatures of little towns or whatever that you run around in.
That's cool.
And I'm just like, oh man, I just want like a toy of that.
Yeah.
Huh. Or like a Lego set of that or something.
There really it should be a tabletop version of these games. Is there not?
Dungeons.
I mean,
right?
Like fourth edition.
I'm standing with, I'm standing next to flanking bonus.
That's funny.
Yeah, no, you're right. I guess I'm imagining more like a printed out game board.
Oh, sure.
Kind of thing.
Sure.
Ooh, that'd be kind of cool, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I prefer tactical RPGs to turn-based RPGs as well.
Yeah.
Because it does feel like, I don't really like turn-based games in general, mm-hmm. I think. Largely because,
you want to hit more buttons than the other guy.
Yeah. Buttons are fun. Pressing buttons is great. And you don't get to press that many buttons in turn-based. You just press to select, and then you just press to pick who you're fighting. And it's... I think with tactical RPGs, there's a lot more interesting decision-making involved. And, you can plan things out ahead of time or in advance and stuff. And I'm not great at that, but, you can do it, and it makes it feel more depth. Yeah. Or it makes it feel more in-depth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a turn-based game, unless there's something you can do in the middle of the actual action, it's just going through a selection menu and picking options.
Yeah, there's a couple times Paper Mario has boss battles. I mean, all these games do, but the ones I'm most familiar with are Paper Mario games. And sequencing your actions becomes a strategic choice. Mm-hmm. And the games that do that well are the ones that really do well. Otherwise, it really is just a matter of hitting the attack button if you know the enemy is weak enough to do it. Just feels sort of like a waste. Even in a platformer game where you have easy things, there's still a possibility of failure.
Right, you can still miss your.
You still have to be consistent. There's an endurance element to it.
Yeah.
I think that there's a demand on these types of games to make those things interesting.
Yeah, I think a lot of them end up adding more mechanics to the turn-based part to make it more interesting. Like there's a game for 3DS that's Bravely Default.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a really cool thing where your turns become kind of a currency. So you can either do an extra attack, or you can either do your turn or you can default. And if you default, then you skip your turn, but the next turn you get two attacks.
Oh, okay.
And so you have to save up your plan when you want to do your double damage or your combos or whatever, because if you have more attacks, you can chain things together.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
So Bravely Default is actually an action.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suddenly that makes sense.
Huh, yeah. I like that. That's cool. That makes it more interesting for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And Octopath Traveler has these boosts that make your attacks more powerful, and you can save them up each turn. Like each turn you get one, unless you used up all of your boosts,
mm-hmm.
in which case you have to skip a turn of getting one, and then you get the one the next time.
Okay.
And you can use up to three at a time, three or four at a time. So that becomes a sort of like, okay, well, I want to use it this turn, or I want to save them up for when. Mm-hmm. So the other cool mechanic with Octopath Traveler is that the enemies have weaknesses, but you don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. Oh. And so you have to try different attacks. And then if you get your weaknesses, if you figure out which one it is, you can break their defenses. So there's like a little defense number and you have to hit them that many times with a thing they're weak to. And if you do, then they become completely vulnerable to all your attacks. So The strategy is to like save up your attacks and use your different characters' abilities in sequence so that you can have all your extra attacks saved up.
Sure.
For when they're weak.
And you have to design like a scientific method, an optimal one that try multiple times that is most efficient way to find your way to the weakness.
Yeah. And so, and there are certain characters who have abilities that will like reveal a weakness or reveal hit points or something like that. Okay. So you can use a turn up to find out information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if
they do that a little bit in Paper Mario too. Like one of the Goombas in the Paper Mario turn-based games, can like read about the enemies you're fighting and you can get hit point information from them.
Which is nice. Cool.
Yeah. I like the Paper Mario ones because there's things you can do in the actions during the gameplay, which is really good.
Right. There's some timed button presses and stuff.
Yeah.
Which we were talking about this before, and I don't know if my guess is that because Super Mario RPG has that,
yes,
where you have to.
Oh, yeah.
Martha, you were playing that at my place a couple weeks ago. And when you hit A just at the right moment, you get a double attack or whatever. And so you have to be a little bit more gameplay than just the choosing your thing. And I don't know if that appeared anywhere else before then, but that's a core mechanic of the Paper Mario series, which even though it is not developed by Rare the way Super Mario RPG was, it was definitely inspired. The first one, they would buy a lot of the things from Super Mario RPG. That I liked that a lot about Paper Mario because as the games went on, they ended up doing more and more of that in a way that was more mechanically interesting or different from game to game.
Right, like Paper Mario 1000 Year Door added stylish moves where you can just like, I think you could get bonus star power if you did it, but like you didn't have to do it, but it was just really cool and fun.
And the more recent games like Sticker Star has you can do them in sequence, and each one you do is harder to time.
Oh.
And so it like you don't always get all the way to the maximum amount, like 6 or 7 or whatever it is, depending on what kind of thing you pull. And again, more mechanics, like you were saying, to give that stuff a little more interest.
Right. That one in particular gives it more of an action game feel, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's a big criticism of those games, the later Paper Marios, is that they're less, like, it's not Thousand Year Door, and that's the sad story, but they're still really fun. Yeah. I really like them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could use another Thousand Year Door. That's one of my favorite games of all time.
My favorite turn-based RPG is Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga.
Yeah?
I played through that game like 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
It's super fun. It's kind of like Paper Mario, except you play as both Mario and Luigi separately, and like, they can defend against enemy attacks by like hopping over them or hitting them with hammers and stuff when they're doing their thing. So like during the enemy's turn, you have things you can do. And during your turn, you can there are button presses you can do to enhance your abilities or to enhance your attack.
Mm-hmm.
And like those, yeah, those ones, those are just super fun.
Mm-hmm. Didn't that game just get a re-release?
It did. It's Superstar Saga plus Bowser Minions or something.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't played that one yet. I have a Switch now, and I think it's on the 3DS. if it was on the Switch, I'd be all over that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. In general, though, I don't know. I don't like turn-based games that much. I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's just too slow.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like Divinity Original Sin? That seems to be on this list.
I did like that. I did. I put it on there because I like that game. But that's more of a tactical RPG. And like... I don't think I would have liked that nearly as much if it was just me playing it. But like, if you can play it co-op, then like you can strategize with somebody else, and you can opt to like not do the thing if you don't want to, which is kind of cool. So I did like that game, but I don't know. What is it you like both like about turn-based RPGs specifically? If you can articulate that,
I like that you have time to think about what you're going to do.
Sure,
and that like I like managing numbers, so like having to manage like how much mana you have or how much health you have or how much, you know, ability points or whatever the special thing is. And figuring out the best way to defeat the boss or whatever. That's really fun. Also, there's always numbers flying off the enemies when you hit them. Yeah. And that is like one of my favorite things. So.
Yeah, I was with you for a while and then not so much.
It's great. And then you do like thousands of damage and then they just poof disappear and you're like, haha, da 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 da. Also, most of the time they have pretty interesting stories. I don't know about how I feel about Octopath Traveler's stories. Some of them are a little annoying.
People seem to hate the story in that game.
Well, it's because some of them are okay. Mm-hmm. Like the hunter who I started with, hers is fine. She's just trying to find her like mentor who has gotten himself lost because he goes on drunken adventures and stuff.
Yeah.
And the dancer's story is kind of interesting because it's really, really dark, but she's like trying to get revenge. And it's like very feminist because she's like, you know, getting revenge against all these really terrible dudes. Mm-hmm. But then there's like we have to link to Polygon's Octopath Traveler's list, it ranked from least to most annoying, because I pretty much agree with everything in that video. Because like then you have like there. Okay, so the one of the characters, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but it's only for one of the characters, and it's the first part of his story. So the thief. His story is that you go and steal a thing and then they catch you stealing the thing. And then this guy puts a bracelet on you and then suddenly he like has control over you, even though it's just literally a bracelet. I'm like, okay.
Sure.
Because they don't explain, like, they don't say like it's magic and he can't take it off or anything. So I'm like, just take it off. Why don't you just take it off? Or if it's like locked onto your arm or something, go to a blacksmith.
Yeah.
This is literally one in like so many in this game. Yeah. But he's like, oh, I'm so upset. Now I have to follow what this guy says for my honor. It's all like, right. What?
Like, they could have done a better job explaining the cultural reasons why that might be true.
Yeah.
Because that might be interesting, but it sounds like they didn't even bother to justify it.
No, it was just like, I have this bracelet now. It means I'm bad. I'm a bad thief. And okay, and the other thing is that part of his story is that he's like, I'm a loner and I like to be by myself. And so these other thieves come up and are like, hey, we want to help you break into the place to steal the thing. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no. But then you walk up with all your other characters and are like, hey, we're going to come with you on your journey. He's like, sure.
I like the voice change.
Anyway, so there's a lot of stuff like that. Yeah. There's a lot of like the female characters being stereotypical, but the gameplay is so much fun that you can just kind of look past that and skip the cutscenes. You press B long enough, the cutscene will stop. So,
okay. Isn't it sad how often you just have to look past that stuff?
Yeah.
Like the world just asks you to do that so often.
Yeah.
That's not cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway. So the stories.
Yes.
Most of the time.
The narratives.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that also explains why I don't like turn-based things. So.
Yeah. I really like platformers, and those are the action games I like.
Yeah.
But I also love stories in games, and the turn-based RPGs are where you can just simmer in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, it's you can play the game without having to be like, without having to have good posture.
Sure.
You could like lay around like you're watching a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's an appealing thing.
Okay.
Not just that they're slower, that they're not, don't require you to be active. It's that that is actually a different kind of fun.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. That makes sense. I guess normally when I'm planning to play a game, though, I'm not looking to like sit down and get immersed in the story and like watch a movie. It doesn't work for me in that way, I guess.
Steven's answer was basically like, that sounds great, but that's not what games are.
That's kind of what I said.
So you'd rather play a sport than like play chess or something. I don't know.
You got him.
That's not a perfect metaphor.
Yeah. Physical activity.
Whatever, you got him.
Yeah, I don't know. I think those points are good. I think those make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not arguing against turn-based. I think it's largely just it's not for me.
Yeah.
Most of the time. I guess that's not the case all the time.
So the challenge is to make a turn-based game that Stephen would like.
Yeah.
Are we asking the challenge now? Mm-hmm. Give it actions in the middle of turns. Yeah. Make it barely a turn-based.
So game. Is it? I mean, this is totally the case for me. But like, yeah. I'm much more likely to play an RPG if it's a Mario game because you know me so well.
Right.
But same with you.
Yeah.
You like the Mario and Luigi games. You like Paper Mario.
I mean, yeah. The reason I played them is because they had Mario Luigi in them. If they made a Kirby RPG, I'd play a Kirby. RPG. Yeah, I'd play a Kirby RPG.
HAL Laboratory, listen up.
Please make a Kirby RPG. I want it too.
Have Intelligent Systems make a Kirby RPG.
Oh,
that would be good.
Yeah, it would. That would be great. Those are the ones who made the Mario and Luigi games.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. That would probably do it. I think it's just the characters. I need characters I could jump in with. Mm-hmm.
Imagine like Kirby's powers in a turn-based mechanics.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That'd be super interesting. Well, there'd be a lot of potential there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like you could suss out what your enemies can do to decide which ones you suck up.
Yeah.
And then you can do them now, but you don't know what they do unless you see the enemy do them.
Yeah.
So like there'd be a ton of interesting strategy involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I can get that. Dang, that's a good game. Okay, get on it, y'all. Come on, Nintendo. What are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it's just largely like if I'm making interesting decisions during the gameplay. I mean, that's what everybody wants. Yeah. But like I feel like with turn-based games, they oftentimes feel like the interesting decision is get the most powerful ability and then just keep using that ability until you run out of mana, then use the next most powerful ability.
Well, the worst of the games are like that, I suppose.
Maybe those are the ones I played.
But I like it for the same reason I like puzzle games,
yeah.
Where it's like you have to figure out the right solution to this problem.
Mm.
And it doesn't require training the way doing a good fighting game or a good platformer would require, it requires actual it becomes just a puzzle you can solve based on knowledge and experience, repetitive action experience, but just perceptual experience.
Right.
Like, I think those are, that makes it really interesting and engaging.
Sure.
Now you've solved my train puzzle.
Well, that's another aspect of turn-based RPGs we didn't really cover is like the grinding. That's so boring.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's part of it.
That's part of the whole numbers gambit that like, that's, I sort of turn away a little bit. The more numbers matter, the less interested I am.
Yeah. That's how I feel about it too.
Yeah.
I think that like for a lot of people, the grinding is nice because like, it's just a repetitive action you can do. And so like, it's just something you can do while you're, you know, not, you can just turn your brain off and beat a bunch of things up, I guess.
I think it's more than that. I think people do like working towards a goal, and grinding is, I mean, in video game terms, grinding is boring.
Yeah.
But in everyday terms, grinding is still playing a video game.
Yeah.
But it feels like work. And then when you get to level 2 or whatever, you can have a sense of accomplishment. So I'm giving it the most positive spin I can.
Sure.
But there is some value to like, you know, chipping away at the wall until you get through instead of just opening a door.
Okay.
Right?
That's a fair point. That's a very fair point.
Even if ultimately it doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's a good call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to find a balance between it. Because, like, if it's too much, then it gets really frustrating and breaks your immersion in the story. Because you're like, okay, now I have to spend a lot of time in this field for some reason. And that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
Did you guys play Chrono Trigger?
No.
No, but I've heard good things.
I played it when it was remastered for the re-released for the DS in, like, 2008 or whenever it was. And I didn't get very far in it. One, it's not really a handheld game. That made it a little bit hard to sort of pick up and get back to. But also, I really loved the story, but it wasn't moving fast enough for me, and the gameplay wasn't as interesting.
Oh.
And I think that's just my assessment. I think popularly, Chrono Trigger is regarded to have really good, solid, engaging gameplay. It just didn't hook me right away.
Okay.
I am interested in revisiting it, though, because I think if I give it another chance, it will get me.
Mm.
But the story like really got me. It just... I wanted the next bit of story and not the next bit of game right now.
Sure.
You know? I don't know. I probably didn't get very far in it. I do need to give that one another shot.
Yeah. I've heard good things about that. It has like a area. It has sort of like a tactical RPG sort of thing, right? Like you have, you don't remember?
Don't remember.
Okay. I don't know. I've never played it.
It was like a decade ago I gave up on this game.
Ah, well then never mind.
But it's haunted me since.
Ooh.
So if you're going to make an RPG, there's lots of tools to do it, including RPG Maker, which has, you don't really have to make much code
for
it. I bought that through like a Humble Bundle or something, but I haven't actually made anything with it. But there's a couple of local people who made some for in a couple of the game jams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know Adina Abduak made one for the latest Global Game Jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it seems pretty fun. I was like looking over Adia's shoulder and being like, ooh, what's going, what is this? And you can be like, set people's abilities and put in your own art and stuff. Mm-hmm. So
and that has seems pretty cool. It does have a coding, a scripting backend. So it's, I think it's out of the box. You can play with it like a toy, like build your own kind of like Legos, but then it is pretty expandable to whatever systems you want to implement on your own. Mm-hmm. I like tools like that, that like let you get started, but then don't hold you back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's good. Are there other tools other than RPG Maker that are?
That's the one that I found.
That's like the major one.
Yeah.
There are like just as is for all genres, there are like kits you can get for Unity.
Yeah,
That will give you a lot of the back end.
Well, I think I'll hand the turn to Steven.
Got it. I picked up on a kit. That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app, and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really do need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club. Lastly, you can find out more about the show, your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and bank nice. I'm sorry. I've totally lost what I was talking about. Sorry to whoever edits this.
I'm just imagining now you editing it and hearing that and being like, ugh.
So